I think we were really kind of making some major progress right before the break. And several things came up, but apparently Scott said that you and Mike were talking, Michael were talking about some things. So you want to?
Yeah, okay. I guess what I was talking about is there's this, so the initial credit recovery providers, that's where I started, right? Mm-hmm. With in the online learning space, we're actually fully computer-based. Plato and Novanet are the two, and they've gotten quite a bad name because of rigor and also not having a human attached to it. And so the online learning movement that's really taken off and jumped over them with Apex and all these other providers and has grown quite robustly are all attached to humans of one sort or another. And the membership body, iNACOL, actually talks about the human standards and so forth. So what intrigued me about Scott's idea was actually it flipped the question back on its head in a way that the existing providers have made input standards that they're not willing to ask that question. But by having the XPRIZE behind something like that might change those dynamics to make it acceptable again. And if you said, oh, we're going to put it past these rigorous assessments to make sure it's real learning with neuroscience and so forth, you could really flip a lot of the assumptions, I think, on its head if you developed something like that. And it would be totally orthogonal to where the online learning credit recovery movement is going right now. So,
could you could you be a little bit more explicit about that? So just a little bit more detail?
Yeah. In what aspects?
I just want to really understand a little bit more about what the problems are, what the arguments were, and what you want to flip on its head.
Yeah, so Scott's question, wrote it down, was basically designing some sort of cognitive tutor function that provides a full course with almost no human intervention and X students percent pass at Y price, or cost, right? And with very little human intervention, what was really interesting about that and different from where the movement is right now. And all I was saying is that all of the dominant online learning providers, which I would call very clearly a disruption in the education space, are all of the ones that are seen as high quality, have humans attached to them, and are very part of the system as teachers and so forth. And in fact, they see quality as reliant on a certain percentage of time would be spent by a teacher for each student or in the course or so forth. And so there's tons of quality standards that have built around that input and how you think about that. So the question that was posed was totally orthogonal to the way that they're thinking about, not totally because there are competency-based models there, but somewhat orthogonal to that idea of quality. And all I was saying is if you set up a prize with X Prize's name behind it, and the idea that you would have the ability to test it on several dimensions, so you could say the students aren't being shortchanged, it is rigorous, it is real, it's giving them what they need, or whatever it might be.
And directly compare it to the ones that have...
Well, I think you would just bypass the question of whether it was good or not, because right now, if you were to come out with a product that did all those things, the movement would say, we're not using it, or would get shunned from the community, or would get banned in some sort of legislation or something like that. So,
there's another model to use, because I think one of the things we would want to do is avoid being too much, here's the solution. I think that it's here's the problem you've got to solve. And I've got great enthusiasm for what Scott had suggested, but interestingly, there is an analogy on the how much human intervention you have, how much you do online and things of that sort out of the financial services world. There was a brief period of time when Wells Fargo was saying, we're going to basically do everything online and we're going to prove that this is the model to be used, et cetera, et cetera. And that was shortly before they almost went banco and got bought out by one of the banks in Minnesota.
Northwest,
thank you, who took the name. But Wells Fargo utterly failed, very, very much along the lines of what you just described, that the online learning group failed. By contrast, Nations Bank, now known as Bank of America, went with a different strategy. And what they did, and others have done the same sort of thing, is to provide the balance of the mix. How much do you want in the way of branch contact? How much do you want in the way of telephone? How much do you want in the way of online? I think it would be more useful for us to describe the end result, which could be measured in terms of cost, because human beings cost money to deal with this stuff, and say you have to be able to provide these services, you know, using technology, but at a cost per child or whatever. However, I assume that's probably the best way to do it.
Yes.
And then let them find out the best mix, which is why you have offices of a Charles Schwab, as well as online, as well as telephone. And there's a huge sophistication behind how all of those things are built together. Getting that balance right, if people can help us to get that balance right, I would argue then that that would also become a fabulous Trojan horse for what you describe in your book, because now we start to figure out how much do you really need in the way of the facilitator, coach by the side, teacher in the classroom, versus how much do you need of a 727 model where the teacher's up front and all of that type of thing. So there'd be huge learning that could come out of that. And so again, I don't think making it an absolute, it has to be all done online, or making it absolute in any sense of that sort is the right answer. What I would suggest is that we want to let the contestants figure out what the best mix is, and the metric is you got to have it at a cost per kid, which would be dramatically less than what the current providers, you know, that do it as 100, well, essentially 100% with human intervention would be.
Yeah, I happen to agree completely. I mean, when I had the last slide of the practical implications, it was basically saying just go to an outcome basis, free up the inputs to be whatever that solution is, fine, right?
You'll never get that solution,
yeah,
frankly, in a traditional school the way things are right now, because work rules around union agreements and all that kind of stuff dictate. And one of the things we don't know is how much do you need in the terms of various different kinds of aids, and how much do you need, et cetera, et cetera.
I don't understand, Mike. What do you mean? You would just say, okay, this is the outcome we want. Now you figure out how
right
to get there.
That's right. And so you might have a cognitive tutor solution that came in with very little human intervention, and as long as it passed the three gates of outcome, maybe you had a test on, did you pass the course? Did you have a, I don't know what else you would do. I'm going to defer there.
My only problem is if it's just pure outcome, I think you're going to attract, I think you'll attract mostly status quo and not some of the new players that know they can make a lot of money in other fields.
If you did cost as well on that, would you say that?
Pardon?
Still? If the cost component was part of it,
I don't think they'll believe it. But if you said what Scott did,
mm-hmm,
I think that would open
so
up
in terms
the world
of making it attractive
to atypical players. I don't think it would preclude the others. And I wouldn't say you couldn't have any, but I definitely would have the cost. But I think it was Scott's, in my mind, it was Scott's, you know, online or digital or, you know, electronic tutorial.
In terms of marketing it, right, to attract people, is that what
that's
you mean?
That's what I mean. Okay. By attracting a wide variety of different kinds of players, not excluding the current players, but extracting potentially mm-hmm players we wouldn't expect to come in to that field. Because you're talking about substantial prizes, right? And it's more than the prize. It's the recognition and the
hugely.
I mean, it's just what you would get out of that, the PR you would get and the brand you would get by winning that prize.
Completely, kind of becomes
and the back end business would be overwhelming.
Yeah,
this is a big business.
I think it would be.
Yeah, it becomes both a good kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval, married to recognition and funding and access to that market. And I know, Paula, earlier you asked, how do you ensure deployment of a winning solution? And I think that was a really good question, because as we look, not a question that we'll answer today per se, but as we look to develop a prize, one of the big parts of our prize design process is evaluating who are all the stakeholders associated, not with just who's going to compete, but who's going to allow the competition to take place, who's going to pave the way for a winning solution to be adopted. And those are two very important questions that are just beyond the guidelines of the prize itself. So in the case, and Francis had spoken about it with the WellPoint HealthX Prize, we needed someone like WellPoint as a title sponsor to make that prize attractive to participants beyond just the $10 million purse. We needed a marketplace of, you know, millions of lives that could be applied to from this solution. In the case of the Tuberculosis Diagnostics Prize, the winning solution, it couldn't just develop and then land into a vacuum. You had to supply a means in which you could access that market, meaning aggregated demand from very developing nations. So we would work in that case and have to partner with, let's say, the Global Drug Facility, which is a purchase aggregator that's supplied through the WHO to actually aggregate demand of small nations. So it's a kind of an advanced market commitment meets a cost-plus model that would pave the way for winning solutions would be guaranteed access into a marketplace to make that successful. So sometimes the prize is more than just the prize. Sometimes you actually have to kind of slick the way to the market. So as we would develop something like this, we'd have to think about that context. Could we have somebody to sign on to deploy the winning solution, you know, be a first deployer? Could it receive some kind of recognition and deployment in a larger school system? Those would be things you'd want to set up in the design of the prize so that it didn't just die with a whimper or even just didn't die with a bang. It actually had a life beyond that. And that's a big part, by the way, of the dollars associated with running a prize. When Francis spoke about operable, it's operable not just during the prize life cycle, but how does this prize make a difference? And paving the way to make that happen can sometimes take a lot of man hours and dollars to make sure that all the right stakeholders are in place. And that means bringing alienating opinions to the table at times.
Can I ask a question about credit recovery? What kind of a test do you have to take to recover the credit? Do you just have to take the course and that's it? Or do you have to take a test?
It depends.
Pardon? Yeah.
It depends is the answer. But let me flip the question the other way for a second, which is how do you get credit to pass a normal course in high school?
Seat time through the normal process.
Right. And so the way like an Apex Learning course would be designed, you can't go to the next unit unless you've gotten 80% on the assessment to go. So it's actually more rigorous, but would you say it's really rigorous? It's an assessment designed within the system, right?
Part of the it depends, Paula, is that in almost every state, and I say almost because there might be a few that don't allow this, but in almost every state, there is an alternative path to a regular high school diploma that bypasses seat time and grade assigned by a teacher because of the overage undercredited problem. If you add to that, also in almost every state, again, I'm saying that because I don't have verification, it's all 50, but it's very close. The number of kids who've already dropped out, if you use Esther's calculation from earlier, when you look at already dropped out age 16 to 21, it's more than 6 million right now. And for those 6 million, if they came back, state money begins to flow back to the local education authority because they dropped back in, if you will. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's an enormous problem to stop. There's an enormous problem to reverse. And that's just the published agenda. The hidden agenda is, and then we go after toppling the American high school as we know it because it's so corrosive with all of these power structures vying for the position of leave it alone because while we don't like each other as competing power structures, at least I know where my enemies are right now, and that's kind of maybe a mean way to explain it, but it's not too far from reality, I think.
Yeah, and it would not be that tough to create appropriate, if we needed to, but I don't know that we would need to create appropriate end-of-course tests, particularly in light of the high likelihood within the time frame this would all happen that the Common Core standards would be adopted. I mean, that's 48 of the 50 states, everybody but Texas and Alaska. And the process is one in which those kinds of tests, I think, would provide a really very high level of rigor because those could be done. What we would need to avoid, just to be clear, because it's got a political disaster attached to it, is the equivalency, the GED test, which has come under a whole lot of, you know, whatever. And just a heads up of that's not a direction that I think would be politically a good way to go because
of
the rigor
issues.
Nor is
it a good way academically.
I'm sorry?
Nor is it a good way academically.
No. No, so that's the bad answer. But we could create, I'm highly confident, we could create a really good assessment on end of course. And that's one of the areas, I think, that as the Common Core comes down, that is getting to be particularly strong. And a lot of states are beginning to focus on that in some very positive ways we could feed into.
But isn't that a short term? I mean, yeah. that's not what you're trying to get to. You're trying to get to the graduation rate.
Right.
Right.
That's
this
what
would
I was
be, well,
about.
Again, one of several measures.
No, yeah, right. I'm sure that's what you meant.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I mean, ultimately, that's just a short term measure to say, yeah, you're making progress. But ultimately, it would be not only did you reclaim or hold on to these eighth graders who didn't pass the test.
Right.
But you dramatically change the graduation rate. You can decide what that is. But
it's got to be something more than, again, my concern is that passing a particular test is content-based. And what we really care about is whether kids drop back in, mm-hmm. who've already dropped out. Those are quantitative. Did they come back to school on their own volition? Whether you paid them to do it or whatever, the question is, are they back in?
And there's enough time on the prize, right? It's like six, seven
usually
years.
Between 5 to 8 years.
So that would be enough time to know whether they graduated or not.
Sure.
Yep. Absolutely.
You bet.
And
that's
what happened after graduation for the early cohorts, right?
Mm-hmm. You could actually did they go in and finish a year of college if you wanted to?
That's what I meant, yeah.
No, there'd be enough time for that, too.
Not what they're doing to get their models straight.
From the day you launch the prize, you're going to need a certain number of years to develop the thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And you're going to want to put it in place. And then from the day you put it in place, your very first group, which may not be the one that it works because you're going to want to iterate on it, it's going to take you 5 years to know whether it worked. I mean, you'll know immediately whether they learn the stuff and pass the test. But it will take you 5 years to know whether that actually led to them staying in school.
Yeah, so it may be structured so that you have interim prize purses.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say.
You win. You had the highest after year one. You win a prize purse of $1 million, and
Francis didn't say it took years to develop the prize, though, did it?
It usually can develop about 6 to 8 months.
Yeah. No, I'm saying once you develop
but
the prize,
they're talking about the technological solution.
The tutoring system.
Yeah, they have to actually come up with their own, I mean, it takes some time to develop the system, yeah.
So that brings me back to this question I've asked several times. I don't kind of get in this model, mm-hmm. if we did this and we said, okay, the goals are get the people who failed Algebra 1 to pass it using an online plus whatever amount of human contact you think they need, and do whatever else you need to do for them to enable them to enter high school ready to be wanting and motivated and able to graduate, and take 2 or 3 years to develop that and start evaluating it and iterate it and follow it for 3 or 4 more years so you see your graduation results. Where does somebody get all the money to do all that while they're waiting for this $10 million prize to come to them 8 years later?
Investors.
Who's going
to give us some sense of that?
Who would be the likely investor that would, or the 15 likely investors?
We want to make sure teams show up to the party. So as we would go through a design process, maybe we'd indicate that, it's really great, and we'd love to be able to track that graduation rate, but we can't do that in a means in which competitors and teams can participate and get funded to do it. So maybe we have a shorter time period.
Well, there's no point in doing it if you're not going to track the graduation. Right?
And
that's the point.
Another issue, too, has been what the XPRIZE does is we try to bring teams together that, A, wouldn't normally show up to a party, right? And, two, we try to create means in which they can showcase their skills or their talents or their ideas and attract that funding. So in the case of some of the prizes, we actually create team ecosystems where teams can, it's kind of a Facebook meets LinkedIn meets Money Tree kind of experience where teams actually solicit investment, they promote their ideas, they try to recruit participants, and in a sense gain the notoriety needed to raise that funds. Do I say it's easy? Do I say all teams are able to do that? Oftentimes that's not the case. And that's also something that when you structure a prize, you have to understand what that prize purse needs to be in order to attract the kind of investment that's going to be required to do that. So this might not be a $10 million prize. This could be a $30 million prize. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head of what it would take for a team to do that, but it might need to be a greater prize purse to attract that.
There's an awful lot of people setting up charter schools, and I'm sure it's not free. There are people who are passionate about education and think they have the answer. And I think that there are going to be people who are going to go after this because they've been thinking about it for a long time. They are willing to put their money where the mouth
time
is
and
or
effort.
Find someone else. Pardon?
And time and effort. I mean, it'll be an enormous amount of effort to.
But I also, we kind of were touching on this at lunch, and I think this is part of the answer. And they weren't going after a prize, but class.com is owned by two government agencies, and it's a for-profit, and the executives who run the company. It just, the way it got developed through this partnership is the City of Lincoln, Nebraska, and the University of Nebraska, government, nonprofit, and the senior execs running class.com own the for-profit as a three-way entity. And I can't imagine that actually wouldn't be pretty healthy. And so transpose that to this. You might say there's this, and by the way, and I think the case with Plato and Novanet is neither of those companies plan to do anything with that stuff. And so you can see, and there are people sort of salivating to take them out of the market or to replace them. So you can see this, you know, literacy partner, this neuroscience type partner, and this school district, or you might see a bunch of collections of those kinds of things, and they go after it with the test bed or the competition being our city or our cluster of schools or whatever, and then out of that they've agreed there's this new company, there's this something, and you know, that might be the way to help this industry disrupt itself by helping take apart its monopoly. I don't know. It's just a possibility.
Yeah, if you actually look at the ecosystem in this particular question, there are a ton of players already there who are competing for this, so they'd all probably do something. But then you'd get all of the people. There's like, I can think of 20 companies in the Bay Area where I'm from in California that are small, doing some sort of user-generated or cognitive tutor or whatever else that are just have no way to actually scale this into anything. They'd love to get to partners. They've maybe raised, you know, a couple million from Battery Ventures or whatever else. So they'd probably all jump in it. The interesting thing about the industry also is that the for-profits that have gotten traction, the Apex Learnings, Ventas of the world, have now become really conservative in their own right, because if they screw it up once, then their whole business sinks. So they're actually not pushing the bleeding edge. Florida Virtual School is the only one that's come out with a full video game based. And they did it with partnering with Electronic Arts. So you'd get probably a lot of gamers who are interested in education to start coming in. So I guess actually you'd get a lot of people at this sort of a table.
We find that prizes allow people to take risks and fail. It's a free space in which they can fail. Because if they win, that's great. And if they don't, not a lot of people really, you know, it's not like they're going to waste their entire company's efforts. So I agree with your point on that.
Maybe you can get an iPad to...
So
I think Apple would almost certainly
absolutely the iPhone Apple the iPhone app.
You're right.
After school iPhone app.
Google. Well, if Apple's going to do it, you know Google's going to not.
I think Disney.
No.
Yeah. And I think too.
Let's say,
it's sort of, if we can envision it right now, that's really not innovation. You know what I mean? That's just describing a solution. I think the innovation is, go as far as you can with getting as much this clean, and then let them run, take off, because it sounds like the end game is somewhat of a surprise at the end, and that's what innovation is all about, which is a little weird.
Unpredictable. That's the whole.
Yeah.
You put things in play, and it's going to sort out in a way that you never could have predicted. I mean, this is. By the way, let me give you a scenario of which I lived through, and this was the was listed as one of the grand challenges that prizes. It was the DARPA, autonomous automobile. So, for probably 10 or 15 years, DARPA has been putting hundreds of millions of dollars to try to get automobile companies to put navigational instruments into their cars so that they could, have a driverless car. It's just to be able to go down roads and across terrain. And you can see why the military would be interested in that, right? Because it'd be truck convoys, all sorts of applications in the military. And typically what happened is, you know, you'd have these contractors would come out and they'd say, well, you know, we can put together a system for, $100 million. And so they get it, $100 million. And so what do they end up with? This truck filled with computers, a huge amount of computers, with a vision system that can barely see, 100 feet in front of it, and the thing crashes. And so nothing was happening. So what they decided to do was to have a grand challenge, and I think it was $2 million, and all comers, you know, and there was no constraints on what kind of technology you could use or what kind of bed you could use. There were some restrictions, obviously, on they had to go from point A to point B, but they weren't told where point B was. It was somewhere in the middle of the Mojave Desert until the actual day of the race. And so the first year, they had like 50 contestants. They had to go around a track once in order to qualify, and so they had 50 who got to that point. And then they started them off one at a time, and not one got more than 2 miles. Some of them just crashed and burned. Some of them forgot to turn on the computer, right? So every possible failure mode you can imagine, and even the big, the robotics groups from Carnegie Mellon, you know, the very well established groups, they just crashed and burned. So they decided 2 years later they had another competition again, the same rules. And now what happened in the meantime is that everyone realized that we just can't use the old technology because that's not going to work. And everybody went for completely new approaches. And the one that won, which actually got across the finishing line within a lot of time, was a small group from Stanford, Sebastian Thrun. And the reason I was involved is that he was one of the general chairs of the NIPS meeting I mentioned that runs this 1,000-meeting conference up in Vancouver. And what kind of technology did he have? Well, here's his technology. He says, look, I don't know how to program the car to drive across a desert and go through all of these roads and everything without pre-programming it. I don't even know how to program it. But what I can do is drive it myself. So what he did was he had a machine learning system shadow him as he's driving down these roads in all kinds of conditions, you know, winding roads, roads that had signs, roads that didn't have any signs, no roads, just flatbeds and so forth. And it kept track of all of the statistics of, you know, what happens if you see this or that. You go to the right, you go to the left. And at the end of the day, his system beat out all of these other pre-programmed systems that were using very complicated GPS algorithms that were pre-programmed and everything. And that was really the eye-opener for everybody, that a small group that didn't have a huge amount of financing, and there were other groups, by the way, that were like that, that did quite well. They were up against groups that had, you know, $10 million, you know, for being funded by some of the bigger competitors. They didn't do nearly as well. And so suddenly now everybody's using learning because suddenly that becomes the technology, the killer technology for this application area. But the point is that nobody could have predicted that. Nobody predicted that everybody would fail the first time. Sure. Nobody predicted that it was the little furry mammal and not the big SUV, right, the big Humvee that was going to actually win the competition. So, you know, this is something that we could, I think, anticipate, that if we start something in motion, we have no idea who's going to actually be the one to cross the finish line.
Well, you know, let me I've been sitting here thinking about who would be likely to engage in this. Paula mentioned charter schools, but you have to realize that charter schools are really publicly funded. They operate outside the system. They get money from the state, so that's how they get their money. I think we need to take that example off the table. But we need to.
I was just saying, in terms of individual people who have vision.
Who have vision, but you know, you got to think about where the money is coming from. You know, follow the money, and that's what I'm sitting here following the money. Okay. So who could compete, if it is credit recovery, and it is going to be like a technology company, who would be the likely people to go out there? Well, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, well, that probably is a natural for Sylvan Learning, perhaps, you know, or one of those, you know, companies.
Did you say Sylvan Learning? Did you say Sylvan Learning?
Sylvan Learning.
Yeah, and they actually launched it. They have a company that does this.
Okay. I don't know all these things. But these are big companies with, and so on. You know, and then I think about, you know, the algebra tutor, that John Anderson developed at Carnegie Mellon, and how expensive that was, and how many years it took to develop this, which is effective. It's been found to be effective. I sit here and I think, well, where's the money? So if a company's going to get into this thing, where are they going to make the money? And it won't be regional because they have to have a pretty large base to make the money. And who's going to pay for the credit recovery? It's the state, it's the school system. If you've already dropped out of the school system, who's going to come back? So, and then you think about all these universities that we're all going to have online divisions and lost their shirt on it. You know, they all got out of the business because they were losing money on this thing. So I like to know how much money can be made from this and who pays for it. So if you put a credit recovery program together for people who have dropped out and brought back, who's paying for that? So if I was a business, I'd be trying to be figure out, if I'm going to invest money, I can get the X Prize, that can give me a jump, right? I mean, I'm not a business person, but I would be sitting here thinking, if I got the X Prize, which no guarantee, that could, I could be launch forward, but I'd have to think that I could really make money off of this. And who is it? Who's going to be able to make money? Sure, there's some venture capitalists who might put some money in, but this sounds like a pretty expensive thing to do.
Well said. And you're absolutely right that nobody in his right mind would do it. However, I would venture everybody here has a PDA in their pockets. And in fact, you have one in your hand. Okay, there was a time when the received wisdom was that nobody would ever buy a PDA, that it's a dead market, that Apple had tried and failed, and it's hopeless. And along came a graduate student of neuroscience at Berkeley who had two kids. He was a programmer, but he wanted to understand how the brain works. He was passionate about it. But he had two kids, and his wife told him that you are not going to support your two kids with your graduate student stipend, and she was right. And so he went and said, look, I can program something, and, I think I could program a little thing that would keep track of your telephone numbers, and he went to people and tried to get money, and everybody said, this is a known dead end. Nobody would touch it. And one after another person would tell him that. So finally, he got some angels to give him a little bit of money, and he put together what's now called the Palm Pilot. And what he did was, there were two things that needed to be done. It had to be small enough so you can put it in your pocket. And the second thing was that instead of having a very sophisticated system, which is what Apple tried to do, that would recognize anybody's handwriting, it forced you to recognize its graffiti. And lo and behold, his name is Jeff Hawkins. It was a hit. Everybody loved it, and it got better and better, and everybody else started copying it. But the point, though, is that just because right now we can't imagine that there is a business here or that anybody would be willing to sacrifice, risk their money, there's a Jeff Hawkins out there somewhere who has an idea that's a better idea, and these are the people we're going to try to attract into the market.
But on top of which, and this may be a reason why it's actually not a good XPRIZE. I'm not familiar with enough to know, but there's actually already a pretty big market for the credit recovery with a lot of for-profits chasing it. Paul Allen was the one that founded Apex Learning. They're growing quite rapidly. It's not just credit recovery. They do lots of others. There's public companies, K-12 Inc., and so forth. So that there's actually already a pretty robust market. It tends to be public dollars that pays for it. That's developed here. So every for-profit online university has a K-12 online business that does this too. So there's actually a lot of people chasing these dollars. That may be a reason it's not a good, because there's already somewhat of a market, but I actually think because it's so underdeveloped and can be so much better, it's actually a huge opportunity. Mm-hmm. And the second part of it would say is it's likely to be that group that figures out a really cheap way that maybe knows nothing about neuroscience or nothing about something, that figures out, gee, if I just have a computer that learns from this mistake in this way, does something, who knows? And it could actually be quite inexpensive to develop, so who knows?
And to that point, I'm kind of thinking here, gee, maybe I need one more entrepreneurial effort before I retire, because I think you can make just a ton of money on it because of the fact that we're doing something here that's very different, and I really want to call it out because it actually not only makes it, in my mind, more than worthwhile, it makes it potentially a lot more fundable in terms of the back-end business. And that is, a requirement that you demonstrate this is way more than credit recovery. If we're just credit recovery, it's nice, but not exciting. This is about changing the paradigm so that the kids don't drop out who otherwise likely would have dropped out and who are behind. And at that point, you now affect the enterprise would have, whatever the company that wins, would have the opportunity to get the public money that would be available to the school districts, because now that kid is in the school district, and an awful lot of the funding, it's changing to some extent, but an awful lot of the funding is, you know, per kid. So if you can keep more of your kids in school as a school district, you get more money, and you could pay some of that to a group that can demonstrate that they are responsible for keeping
their
kids in.
6+ million who already dropped out, if they come back, they bring back with them, in the lowest funded states, more than $6,000 per head, and in the highest funded states, more than $13,000 per head. That's enormous money
that
would come back to something, right?
Right. Okay. Shall we switch directions just a little bit and begin to do some brainstorming on the pre-K readiness? Because I think we've kind of come to a very nice place with this possible, you know, 8th-9th grade bridge and, you know, keeping kids in through high school for graduation. What about the early years? Because I think many people were interested. And by the way, one of the offline discussions we had, just to kind of bring, and this is all in the details, but I think that in addition to looking at disaggregating by socioeconomic class and by, race and free and reduced lunch, whatever, I think we need to disaggregate by gender. And also potentially by science and math as well as literacy or whatever, so that we make sure that if we develop a prize, it ultimately is going to help level the playing fields across all of the talent in the country. So that should make Sally happy and a couple of other people. So that was just something that didn't want you to think we haven't thought about. We know that at one point I think NSF had a meeting about the development of technology and how women had begun to kind of climb up the ladder in terms of equal pay for equal work, just about the time that technology jobs really began to take off. And I think the statement that I remembered was that you could probably roll a bowling ball through Silicon Valley and not hit a single woman.
Oh.
Okay. So just as an analogy, that stuck in my mind all these years. And that's because many, many of these early games are very exciting shoot 'em up games for little boys.
Right.
And make them very comfortable with technology and not very much for little girls. So if we're interested ultimately in understanding all the talent and recovering all the talent, we might want to look at that, not just kids who are failing in more academic ways, but in terms of future productivity for the whole workforce. Okay, so shall we start and talk about the pre-K and what, or did you have something you wanted to say, Esther?
Yeah, so I just wanted to say that I thought we should focus on parents and as the number one teacher and see what we could do to encourage parents to be engaged and to see themselves as a critical part of their child's success. So when children are born, they come home from the hospital and they have like a little sort of timetable on when to get your vaccinations, right? 3 months, bring them in for this, 6 months and that, so forth. How about some kind of a timetable for what you should be doing from an intellectual perspective? And it would be great to give somebody a prize who can really engage all the parents and get them, or I don't know, a certain percentage, or I don't know how we would do it, but that's what I think. Parents really need to be part of the picture.
Yeah, my question.
I think it definitely needs to include parents, but it also needs to include this whole childcare industry,
it's custodial care, not learning care. Right?
Where a huge number of disadvantaged kids spend a huge number of hours of their day. So I think it's parents plus childcare plus these kind of preschool programs. That it has to be all of them, and maybe pediatricians also. I don't know. And there's this fairly finite little group of entities that really impact preschool kids.
Yeah, I agree that the child care group should be included too. They're really important because they do take care of a lot of kids, especially of the working parents. And so So they should have a stimulating program of some kind, and I don't know how they can do it. I mean, I think that we could leave that open, but it would be great if we could, I mean, a prize for the city that has the child care that is the most, that prepares the greatest number of kids, or they're kindergarten ready, or whatever we would come up with as some kind of a prize. But those years are critical. And right now, a lot of kids have substandard care. And I mean, most of the parents just put their kids in front of a TV, which is a pretty sad situation.
Well, I mean, many of the parents who are the kids' first teachers are haven't actually developed their own cognitive skills very well, have they?
No.
They're your high school dropouts in many cases. And so whatever solutions that we're developing potentially for the discussion we just had, there's no one who says that we couldn't also make those available
would it be
to parents.
Something as simple as, and I don't really know the literature well enough, but could you take a couple of keys, if I'm right about these two being key, could you take, we were talking about in the hall, in the lobby this morning, could you take something like the Hart-Risley gap or the Michigan 40, whatever that one was, that, you know, they spent all those years with, you know, a small number, and just close those gaps up based on some pre-K supports through the child care and parents and whatever. Is that too simple?
No, that would be
amazing.
And
let cities compete. That might be the, because those are the two I know. I don't. Maybe there are others.
And Joy, I don't. Well, I don't see. I don't see how you do it without some technological innovation.
Oh no, no. Well, that no. So I think that you'd leave it to them.
No, I don't think you can leave it to them, because I think the industry is going to. You look at where it is today. I mean, industry is going to migrate to what it knows.
Okay.
I don't think if you got to bake it into the prize some way.
Okay. So sold. So yeah. Through technological innovation. What?
Plus.
Yeah, you
whatever,
know.
Blah, blah, blah. The city that closes Hart-Risley the most, or the Michigan, I can't even call that study what it is, but you guys know what I'm talking about, right? Close those gaps up the most over a certain period of time, done. So you did tease them out with, tease out the technology and a couple of other things that.
Well, the problem with the heart, trying to close the Hart-Risley gap, is that it has to do with the number of words a child has been exposed to and whether they're positive or negative. So you could certainly, you know, figure out ways to expose the child. You would have to be able to track how many words a child was exposed to. I think
use baseline for that city when you start, no?
I think tracking the number of words a child is exposed to is something that's not very easy to do.
So that's not the outcome anyhow. That's the input.
That's the input.
Oh,
so,
but closing it up at the other end, would
well,
that not
the
be?
Closing it up at the other end, aren't there, I mean, can we ask just a practical question? What are the preschool ready? I mean, how do you determine
right.
if a child is preschool ready?
But you're the one that's supposed to know that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not in the public school, so I want to know what it is that.
No.
So, yeah, there are. Yeah, there are.
We don't want to know. Do they know their colors and their letters and that stuff? We want you to tell us what cognitively they should have done, should be, how cognitively they should be developed.
No. You should. The parents should. No, it shouldn't be. Parents should be able to determine it. So kids should be able to. They should recognize colors. They should be able to determine whether it's a potato or a tomato. They should be able to count a certain.
All that stuff is true, but if there's some cognitive bunch of.
There are. We know where they are. We just can't name them in here.
And then you can figure out a way to. Measure them.
Right. Well, we already know that kids who can say the alphabet by the age of 4 are more likely to become good readers. I mean, there's a big study with many, many very fancy evaluations, and that one was very important.
You have to just behavioralize it in a
way.
Yeah,
so you have, and it's not that hard to behavioralize. And the phonological awareness, I mean, there's a variety of very standardized tests that are done. It's very well known that's highly predictive. Early language development.
It's in the home. Dealing with the home, the environment they're in.
Right. Well, you have to. So
you
have to do that.
You have to tackle
executive
all
function.
That point, yeah.
Right.
There are ways to do that.
But see, just that little tidbit like that you gave, you know, kids that know their alphabet by 4, how many parents know that?
They don't know that information.
They don't know that. So maybe if there'd be some kind of guideline, your child should know the alphabet by four. They should learn the colors by two. You know, I saw a video from Jamie Oliver, this guy from the chef from the United Kingdom. He showed a classroom full of kids, fruits and vegetables. They could not name a potato or a tomato. That's where I got that from. I mean, kids don't know this stuff.
How old are they?
They were like first grade, kindergarten.
One
they didn't
that
know.
One group started doing this work is the Nemours Children's Hospital, where we did the Brain Summit, yep. You know, in Jacksonville, and they funded DuPont money, and they funded a child find get it, and their whole thing is try to catch those kids more prone to dyslexia way early and start intervening much earlier. But there are some entities like that that have gotten some starts in this. The problem is it's kind of a mess, and we can't. It's so organic that nobody really can take anything to scale because we don't have enough evidence and understanding of the operation to take it to scale. That's
so the nurse family practitioner program that I think either Kellogg or Casey has funded for 20 years
right.
now has all this huge amount of data, and they are trying to take that to scale. And I don't know what piece of this puzzle they solve, but I know they say that sending these like home nurses to all these families that come at some periodicity and have some bunch of stuff they teach the parents has this huge impact, and it's not that expensive.
It's not that expensive?
They're trying to take it to scale in a lot of places.
They can compete.
You know, I think
a lot of people try to take things to scale. But
I think that may be in the health bill to have.
I think they are in one of. But the nurse family practitioners aren't just doing health. I think they're also doing this cognitive readiness.
So we can already envision some potential.
So that would be maybe a piece of it.
Of this, or you know, or
you
a couple.
Have to glom onto that. Some more than that.
But again, we shouldn't focus on how. We should focus on letting them do it because it may be. Let's say you gave the money to a city. The city may want to share the prize money with. You know, with a bunch of community-based organizations.
And should.
Mm-hmm. Let them figure out what
right.
The point is to let a lot of innovation flower.
And it's likely to be a combination of things that works.
Parent training.
I mean, that's one of the other things that hasn't come up, but I imagine that if we have a multi-tiered system, that also would potentially get people who are getting towards the goal to have the... potentially, rather than competing, to say, well, if I can get 20% improvement and you can get 20% improvement, maybe if we combine forces, we could really
Bingo.
Win this prize.
Bingo.
And that's not against the rules. So it may, as we said, there's not one silver bullet. And what we're looking for is lots of different innovative ideas that raise a specific bar. We're not going to say what those ideas are right here. We're going to say, what's the bar we're trying to raise?
Right.
And then if the bar that we're trying to raise is a certain amount of English language skill by the time you enter school, that's pretty easy to test. You know, we understand how to test language skills. If the bar that we want to raise is whether you can say the alphabet by the
right.
time you enter school, that's pretty easy to test. So if we can just figure out what the metrics are, then everyone gets to compete. And it also means that lots of good ideas get tested. I mean, that's the problem we're in right now. Lots of good ideas out there.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people competing to try to improve these outcomes and no follow through in terms of really knowing what worked, how much did it cost, and how long does it take to get there?
Yeah, Paul, I would say the thing I've been most surprised about, I think there are not good, inexpensive measures that are available to the typical parent, even the highly educated parent.
I know.
So, you know, and you get a lot of conflicting information. And pediatricians are the worst.
They are.
So whatever they tell you, I'm sorry, I hope there are no pediatricians in the room, but whatever they tell you,
most
be careful
parents,
because they'll tell you not to worry.
When most
you,
parents
when you
don't have any idea.
Deeply worried.
Most pediatricians, parents, I'll give you a really interesting, amazingly depressing study. Most parents, pediatricians, even teachers, preschool teachers and early first grade teachers do not have any real understanding of the range of language milestones, what they are and what the appropriate range is for a child. So here's a study. It was an epidemiological study that was done in Iowa with a random sample of children going into the first grade. They were just merely given a standardized speech evaluation, language evaluation, that would have been done by any speech-language pathologist. They found that 7.3% of children going into the first grade met the diagnostic classification of specifically language impaired. Now, here's the that's a huge number. Here's the really frightening part. Only 29% of those children had ever been identified by anyone as having any issues in language.
Good Lord.
Those kids are going to go to school, and the first thing that's going to happen is some say, this child is not reading readiness. Let's give them extra reading time.
So saying that, Paula, then why? Because I was struck by, so one of the first steps could be readily available assessments that parents could use, that any parent could use.
Right.
So you wouldn't have to have a PhD in neuroscience to use this. Any parent could use it, and it would be very inexpensive to use. So there, I mean, today there's all kinds of things on the web. You can take all kinds on the Facebook. They send you one every day. You're going to take to see.
What right? kind of animal are you?
Right, there you go. So, but
pregnancy test,
they
can get it at Walgreens.
There you go. There you go. So, you know, that'd be a first step, and then because now you've got assessments they could use. Then you could go to the real prize that you were going to.
Yeah,
you're
going to
drive, because I know now what my six-month-old should know. I know what, because I look at babies different after watching this testing you guys did. Mm-hmm. I never knew what to look for other than they're kind of cute.
So it's a metric-based prize first, is what you're arguing. And that's absolutely what this conversation sounded like. You have to agree on the metrics that you'll use and the metric that would ultimately be deployed in the team to improve that. So you have to be able to compare apples to apples.
Yeah, if you just
knew. One question is whether if you measured what proportion of your community's free and reduced lunch eligible kids were ready for kindergarten, say as a measure, however you define ready. Do we also measure whether they still are at grade level at some later grade?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Sure.
That's really important.
And how are you doing as
that's,
a city?
That's the outcome.
An entity is what I was trying that's to get at late, earlier. Yeah, right.
Because that's the problem with Head Start, right? I mean, Head Start shows some great early signs that it looked like, boy.
Well, maybe the problem with Head Start, or maybe the problem with the schools that the kids go into.
Actually, Head Start has some very good outcomes if you look long enough.
They have pretty good outcomes.
And if you look long enough, you'll see that the participants in Head Start and their match controls, that the participants are less frequently identified for special education, they're less frequently incarcerated, they're more likely to be employed, and so on. On a lot of factors, Head Start made a big difference. The problem was that we started off thinking that we could raise IQ and that it would be permanent. We had the wrong variable in the beginning. So
you're saying that kids that went to Head Start don't wind up in prison?
As often?
Yes, that's right.
I wouldn't aware of that stat.
Excuse me? The latest follow-up studies of Head Start individuals as adults have shown that compared to their controls, they're less likely to be incarcerated, less, you know, and so on. So in essence, what we have is Head Start helped produce better citizens for society. And in a way, that's what schools were actually designed to do, was to prepare people to live in a democracy. That was the original intent. When we start talking about these parent programs, the people who will, so we have to think about now is, okay, how do we make sure that the parents who really need these are going to get it? Because, you know, heck. You had that, I'd run out and buy it. But you know what? My kids would be school ready anyway. Okay?
Now, you don't have the dropout metric that was very, you don't have the credit recovery metric that identified who needed to do it like you do in the earlier example. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can identify kids who are poor, who are at high risk, and you can, but again, we don't have we have to have a system of who's going to train the parents, you know, so it's just making it available.
Part of the innovation,
not gonna,
though,
yeah. And so you're going to have a system, and who's going to give it to them? Who's going to pay for it? I'm just saying that if you think it's going to be the parents who run out and buy it, you're only going to get, only those parents who are already doing well are going
to
go out and buy it.
But give it
part of this, too, is that we're not the ones, I think part of us who've been, I'll speak as a practitioner, and I'm usually very defensive on our behalf.
we are so much the part of the problem with all of these things. Part of this is to set the parameters and then let someone leapfrog us. That really is a huge problem with superintendents and colleges of ed and school boards and all of us. We are so much a part of the problem. Set the parameters and let's let the creativity go. It's just an enormous issue that we gotta take our share of the blame and do our share of stepping out of the way and letting some of this get solved because we haven't done it.
Could I quote you?
Yes, sir, you can, because I feel so strongly about it. You know, it's and I think that's how we help. We can add enormously to it with our domain expertise, but we shouldn't try to control it because we're a huge part of the problem. Let the innovation take place here, you know?
No, that's not the point. I think as you put the innovation in place, I think you have to be thinking about how it's going to get to those hard-to-reach populations.
Well, that would be part of the
which we haven't done either, right?
Right. No. So I mean, that's my only point. It's you know, who buys Einstein videos? Okay, we can argue about whether Einstein videos are effective or not, and I think there's some data that says that they're not. But let's just say that they are. Who runs out and buys them?
A lot of parents do.
I know, but it's the parents whose kids don't have the vocabulary, who don't know the alphabet, who don't know the colors, who are not buying it. And if we want to make effect in the change of the school system, we need to reach them. Okay, that's my only point. It needs to be built. It's not that I'm squashing innovation, but if you don't think about it, it won't happen.
In other words, that is part of the specification of the prize, I think someone said, which is that if you want a particular group to be targeted, then you have to make that the requirement that you target this group.
Right. And I didn't hear that. That's what I was trying to say.
Tell me what you want to do, what things you do, and then we'll bring the market savvy and et cetera, and either make the prize or not. There's the name of the game here. That's what they're saying. Not for us to do that. He's in the game, so he can
flirt
some of you with that question.
But so, Camille, our influence would be define the problem, help design the prize, and that goes with the measures. So we would control. That would be our way to influence. You get at those things you're talking about, but then step out of the way of the innovation. I think is the Absolutely. That's the parameters. For
yeah,
the
I'm not getting into that. I'm just trying to set up the parameters.
Right. Which I think that's
Well, the parameters definitely would have to focus on the most at-risk kids. And so, I mean, let's say you're saying the city that can close the gap of kids who are school-ready based on X, Y, and Z criteria between their lower SES and kids who are going to be identified as free and reduced lunch and their kids who are not. I mean, you can get
there's metrics
any way you want.
I would argue against that 1,000%.
Okay, good.
I would argue for a cost criteria that would make it accessible.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that kids of poverty don't have access to telephone, to cell phones?
No, they do.
Sure, they do. And if you get the cost points right, then I think you will get access, right? And you will bring innovation. But the minute you preclude the parents who are spending billions on learning, you've now excluded a huge segment of the market and you've driven it to the government to solve it, and they're running out of money. So don't do that. I mean, but by cost, by defining what the cost has to be, you now can make it accessible. So you
could do it either way, and you could develop something that, and we don't have to actually specify that.
That's what I'm arguing for. Don't specify.
Well, no.
The result we would measure is whether these high needs kids got there. Whether you did it by marketing something that was available to everybody, or you did it by focusing your resources on the high needs kids, we don't have to decide. But what we want to measure, the high needs kids get there. We don't want to measure whether my kid got there.
I think we're getting too detailed because, I mean, it could well be that at the end of the day, you'd need to have two separate, as you pointed out, you could have for the TB prize, there are four separate prizes for, you know, and you can have, imagine, if, you know, it down the road, there'd be a separate prize for at-risk kids, a separate prize for kids at charter schools, a separate prize for kids at, you know, public schools of a certain type. And you know, you'd have to separate that out because you otherwise it'd be apples and oranges, right?
Absolutely.
But I don't think we need to do that right now. I think that, you know, we could, on the table, we can say, look, there is a lot of different dimensions here. We can sort of plot out those dimensions, but we don't have to decide that we have to do it this way or that way.
So, I mean, except so we end that up you with don't, two what you don't want is to end up with the community that is 80% wealthy to win because 82%
no,
there, of their kids...
There will be a separate competition for the 80% who are wealthy, and that will be different.
We have to do a competition for them.
We have to trust XPRIZE to know what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you could identify the communities that, you know, at a population level had parity, right? Maybe it's the lowest performing, it's the poorest counties, it's the poorest cities, however you want to define it. You can define the playground in which you operate that prize. But I think one of the most important discussions here today is that there was no consensus on what it meant to be ready when you entered kindergarten. And I think that discussion and that metric is going to be something that's a great next step.
And that's, I don't think
actually,
that's huge.
I disagree. I think we could. I mean, maybe
yeah,
people.
I think
maybe you could.
We just didn't set out to do it.
I agree, Camilla.
That's so straightforward.
Okay, so maybe that's my own naivete in this space.
No, we could. That's so. I think that is pretty much so straightforward.
Well, and once you pick those elements and agreed upon those, a lot of those issues of who got that element, who was targeted, a lot of those will play out. Mm-hmm.
It's just that preschools are not universally funded, you know, and so you know, I'm just, again, if you're going into a community that's 90% poverty, you're talking about, I'm trying to think about backbone business. Okay, so who's the backbone business and how are they going to make their profit on this? If it's a community that's 90% poor and there's not universal preschool, so who are you selling it to? I'm not trying to be difficult. I know it feels like it, but I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm just trying to think through this, the business model here.
Well, yeah, for example, one of the things that we didn't want to do is incent a next generation TB diagnostics for the United States that had less than 2% of the tuberculosis cases in the world. So we implemented a advanced market commitment. Maybe there is some kind of agreement with a government-based subsidy that, you know, they agree to acquire that technology and deploy it in the poorest school districts. Maybe for others, they have the rights to sell that product in outside of identified markets to make their own margin as needed. So you can set up structures to make that happen.
Yeah, I'm just trying to.
Mm-hmm. Bob is probably the one who can answer this question the best, right? In terms of.
I think again, if you get the cost right, I don't think it's a problem. I think we're thinking in one dimension. If you get the cost right, just go down to Walmart. You're telling me that they're just the rich parents in there buying toys? No, they're not. No. Parents care about the kids, and I think if you get the cost right, then you'll open it up to all the avenues.
Certainly, but I find that for an XPRIZE, only from the XPRIZE perspective, the least number of bullet points you have in describing what the rules are, the more successful that competition will be, because people feel like they have a chance to do and compete.
But there are lots of homes that don't have books.
And maybe those are great prizes for other people that can apply that in a smaller context. Maybe it's not an XPRIZE. Maybe it's a great Department of Education prize.
Do we come to some kind of vote on this? Do we say yes, please? Let's go ahead.
That's actually a good wrap up.
Well, what is the next step, really? Is that what should we do from here? So,
okay. Well, I asked Francis and also Eileen what does happen now, you know, because it's time to kind of wrap this up. And one of the things that I said that we could definitely do is, I said, develop this email list so that we're all in touch with each other. And as people have ideas going forward, they just put them on the list and or small subgroups get together. What I had envisioned would be that we would end up with some specific ideas, which I think we have, and that we might be able to have some subgroups develop that say, I'm really wanting to go after this one versus that one. Or I'm really willing to kind of pull in some more funding, because I think what we're hearing from the XPRIZE Foundation is we have to raise a certain amount of funding to go forward. So why don't we turn it over to Eileen now and tell us what the next steps are.
Yeah, so the XPRIZE, we're not an endowed foundation. So we operate a little bit more like a consulting model on a nonprofit base. So we essentially have to have billable hours for projects that we develop. So the work we do in developing X prizes and X challenges take anywhere from 3 to 9 months, depending on their complexity. We usually identify target sponsors to develop the first phase of our analysis. That's essentially phase one. At that point, we have a go, no-go decision both with our sponsors, and board of trustees. And if the answer in the decision is yes at that point, we're essentially committing to launching that. So we're committing to raising the funds, finishing the development, and launching that opportunity. So all told, it varies, right? It takes anywhere from $300,000 to $600,000 to actually create a prize from scratch, and that's all the way through to launch. And then, of course, the prize budget itself is variable. You have prizes that cost $10 million to operate or $5 million to operate, and some that cost $24 million to operate. So a big part of that is raising the funds, not just for the development, but for the prize purse. And all the people, if you look at the winner scene, all the people behind the picture that allowed that prize to happen. And we work to develop that with foundation partners. So, for example, Progressive Insurance is our title sponsor and operational sponsor for the Progressive Automotive X Prize. There's the
Progressive what?
Progressive Insurance Automotive X Prize. That's the 100 miles per gallon equivalent car. The Archon X Prize for Genomic, it's actually an individual family that funded that prize and its operations. The Google Lunar X Prize, don't have to explain that one. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation sponsored the development of the Tuberculosis Diagnostics X Prize, and we're actually partnering with them now to raise the sponsorship dollars to launch it. So we have a number of both individuals, foundations, corporate sponsors. We work with a gamut of people to make a prize happen.
So I think that we could say that we definitely made some major progress in identifying two potential areas that are tractable, that have definitive outcomes that can be defined quantitatively, and would be open to competition. And so I think from my perspective, I'm very pleased with where we are at this point. I just want to make sure that we all go forward. So I don't know whether we want to think more carefully about whether we need to develop a couple of subgroups to work further together, or we want to maintain ourselves as a full group, or how we want to go from here.
Well, I just have one question, though. Sure. Eileen, is it $200,000 to $300,000 to develop multiple prizes, or $200,000 or $300,000 for each prize?
That's a good question. So our phase one, which is usually between $150,000 and $200,000, is essentially where we boil the ocean. So we might come up with a few prize ideas, let's say the top two or three. Okay. From there, we'll probably decide on which one is most fundable or which ones are most fundable, plural, depending on what that would take. Complete the development cycle of either of those or both of those or one of those, and then decide on launch.
Okay.
So arguably $500,000 of commitment from some source.
Correct.
Should buy the time, and then comes the capital.
Exactly.
Yeah. We're not talking about $60,000 or so.
And the
so
process,
identifying who that might be,
exactly,
is something we'd each want to be a party to.
And in terms of the process, essentially we create an advisory committee, very not unlike this group here, that is, you know, you're participating in individual phone interviews, you're involved in advisory committee meetings where they progressively get more difficult because you get progressively closer to creating an operable launch prize. So when it comes to developing the metrics, we get down and dirty and bring a lot of people that have different opinions to the table in doing that.
What I understood Francis to say earlier, though, just before I left, was that although they are distinct, I mean, the preschool and the 9 to 12 or whatever, if they were, they could conceivably at some point be yoked together on the same technology platform or something.
Very possibly. I haven't seen that precedent, but I could absolutely see it happening here, given the consistency and similarities behind them. And the basic premise and teams that might compete.
So is there a body that contracts with XPRIZE to undertake the consulting relationship?
Typically,
and what is that body?
So
who is that body?
In this instance, we've contracted with a foundation, the Gates Foundation. We've contracted with individual donors to do that.
Donors is one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you contract with the donors, you contract with the donor, or something more than that.
What's the deliverable, you mean? Or who signs it? I think that would be variable, depending on if it was a group, a party, that wanted to be involved in sponsoring that. Multiple donors, for example, multiple clients. A single corporate entity, a single foundation. I think we'd be open to any and all of that relationship, as long as we spelled the names right.
Well, that's for all of us to hear.
So without asking anybody to come in, I'm just curious to know who would want to be on a subcommittee for one or the other, or both, just to get a show of hands.
I don't think everyone heard the question.
I didn't hear that.
Who would be, okay, the question.
To continue in
yeah,
some way.
For the next step, if we created a subcommittee or subcommittees for one or the other or both, how many people would be willing to participate in that next step?
And how many people want to go forward with this process and continue to just be involved?
Right. Unanimous.
Unanimous.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, I think it's getting time to wrap this up. I think the timing is pretty perfect. For those of us who's interested in the role of time and timing and learning, I think we learned a lot in one day. So we will be going towards our next step. I think we accomplished quite a bit, and we know that everyone who's here is as interested, if not more interested, that got them here to begin with. So that's a great outcome and income. And so let's go to dinner.